accession number 19990, reel 3.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 3. You were saying, again in the first year, there's a big emphasis on physical training.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any particular aspect of physical training that was emphasised? Were they concentrating on strength or on endurance or on agility or anything in particular?
No, I think you had every sport available to you. There was swimming pools that were good. There was the gymnasium for the boxers. You could do weight training, athletics, and of course football, rugby, hockey, cricket. It was sorting out the sort of aptitude. I mean, a lot of the Pakistans were excellent at hockey and cricket. The same with the Ceylonese, and boxing in particular. The Burmese were good boxers. And so you had various trophies going, the Barrington Kenneth Trophy. We had a huge gymnasium, and as I say, we were talking a lot of the physical training instructors were actually RAF coaches and responsible for inter-service. So on occasions you got a Halton apprentice actually representing the RAF at basketball or things like this, because the people were on site that knew where the talent was. And you had to do sport, whether it would be cross-country running. You found a sport that you were comfortable with or good at. And, I mean, a lot of them boxed, played rugby and swam. They were good at all three. But the station revolved around it, really.
What did you do?
Well, I did rugby and I did cross-country running. I wasn't very good. I never represented Halton at any of the sports. So you had to go, I think, at boxing at one time. But very soon, they sort of knew your potential. Yeah.
Were there regular sports afternoons?
Oh, yes. Wednesday, I think I remember Wednesday afternoon was a sports afternoon. And I think everybody did it. You had to do something.
Another thing you mentioned was the weapon training, and you've already said that you were issued with rifles. When did that happen?
Well, you were issued with the rifles the moment you got there. I think you did a basic sort of training on the rifle and went on the range and fired it. And in each barrack block, there were 18 rifles chained to the wall at the far end. And these were, I think the NCO kept the key, and they were used for ceremonial sort of parades, or you went on the range and what have you. You spent a lot of time cleaning them and the webbing slings that went on them and so on, but they were ordinary Lee Enfield.
How did you get on with the rifle?
Okay. Yeah, I think most people were quite capable shots. Once again, in the sports line, there were marksmen and there were equestrians. You know, you name it. If there was a sport, they were involved with it.
What sort of distances were you shooting at when you went on the ranges?
Normally, it was just a 25-yard range?
Miniature range.
They were sort of within 100 yards, I would have said. Now, once a year, you went on a camp up to Altcar, Altcar was the one I went to in Lancashire, where you were doing, I think it was the Edward V Trophy or something, and you used to have to run so far and fire and all this sort of thing. But on the Altcar ranges, we were firing sort of 1,000 yards or more. You know, it was there was two or three summer camps that they used to call, one at Kenley, I think, but.
Yes.
You were using sort of more or less proper army facilities.
Sounds more like field firing. Did you ever take part in a falling plate competition? Do you remember?
Can't remember.
It's where you have steel plates and you have to run forward to firing point and then knock over the plates, and it's run as a tournament. You have two teams competing.
I mean, we did have sort of competition shooting, but whether it was the one you describe, I'm not sure. But
do you recollect doing any snap shooting?
Oh, yes. Because we fired, although our basic weapon was a rifle, we also fired, I can remember firing the Bren gun.
Yes.
And I think I fired a Sten. Mm. And pistol shooting.
Another thing you mentioned is, what about grenades, by the way, whilst we're on the weapons?
We did grenades, but they were all practice grenades. I can't remember ever throwing a live grenade, but we certainly were explained what grenades were and practiced throwing them and so on. But I don't think I ever threw a live grenade.
And do you remember ever doing anything like section tactics or platoon tactics?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you also, I mean, we had gas drill and we went through the gas chamber. This was a course conducted by the Rock Apes, as we call them, the RAF regiment.
Yes.
And, of course, they had brought their own training syllabus from the work that they did to train us with. Mm. So we did more or less sort of standard regiment training to do with gas warfare and safety precautions, firefighting and artificial respiration, all that sort of thing was on this this course.
Do you remember, was that done at Halton?
Yes.
It was.
Yeah.
When you were doing these tactics, up to what sort of level would you do it? Would you be going up to company level or just platoon and section? Or?
No, I mean, you're referring to the army, which I'm not familiar with, but we'd be sort of taking up sort of lines of fire and all this sort of thing. Probably the work of an NCO in charge of a small party, that was about it.
Yeah. How many would there be in your party? Do you have any idea of the numbers?
Probably six to, they group us up into little numbers, six or so.
Up to about sort of section level, really.
Yeah.
Did you do anything on living in the field and camouflage and fieldcraft?
Oh, yeah, yes, that came into it, although I can't remember. More when you went on the summer camp and building tents and this sort of thing. But we certainly touched on these sort of subjects, but only briefly, except when you went to the camp itself.
Now, on to the more technical side of it. You mentioned education also in your notes. What did you have to do in the way of education in that first year?
Well, you were concentrating on engineering science.
Yes.
We took five subjects, I believe. One was, it was mechanics more than physics. So you did maths, English. Now, there was English language and English literature, and then there was what they called general studies, and then engineering science. It was related to your own, we did a lot of heat.
Yeah.
In science, because we were going to be engine fitters, it was all heat and so on, light and so on. Whereas I think some of the others may have had a slightly different syllabus because of their particular trade. Mm. But it was designed to take you to national certificate. That was the course we were doing, national certificate.
What were you doing in the way of English literature? Do you remember what that covered?
I can't remember very well, but I mean they were sort of making sure that you could write English and punctuate it and so on, and it doesn't sort of come back to me. I mean, you wrote essays and stuff like that, but I can't remember what we had to read.
The usual way is to have set books, isn't it, and have to write.
And
the general studies, do you remember what came into that?
No, once again.
Do you recollect if you had any current affairs or anything like
that? I would have thought so. Current affairs and RAF history and sort of geography and so on. But that part of it, you for the first year, I think you did half and half, more or less. Mm. And then gradually the schooling got less. Unless, of course, you'd failed something and then you had to do additional schooling. But
And the technical side will take more priority.
Education.
Yeah. And how was the teaching carried out in these educational subjects? What method of instruction did they use?
Well, we had classrooms, we had laboratories. In the book that I've got down there, it shows you the schools, and you were led from classroom to classroom, and there were some sort of lecture halls where you were on tiers and so on. But once again, the mind is getting a bit thin on schools, because it was the thing I enjoyed.
Do you remember who was doing the teaching? Was it done by...
Squadron leaders and flight lieutenants, education officers. And of course, on the engineering side, there were a lot of RAF sergeants, flight sergeants, and civilian instructors who had been, retired from the RAF as flight sergeants and warrant officers and so on.
And
some of them had been there for years. Oh yeah. I mean, there was Mr. Saunders who taught the coppersmith and tinsmithing. He'd been there, all through the war. Everybody remembered him, you know. But, there were some good people there.
So he was highly experienced?
Well, he knew the subject he was teaching absolutely backwards.
So you got the first year, which was, it sounds like the first year was really a rather tough year, and then it gradually became more interesting and less difficult as time went on.
Mm-hmm.
So you, and it was 4 years overall?
The standard course was 3 years, but I did an extra 8 months.
What did you do during that 8 months?
The problem was that you were recoursed, so you went over the ground again, and it took you the sort of extra 8 months, but you still had to go through all the
course. So you went back to a previous intake?
Yeah.
Yes. Did many people get back squatted in that way?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, some through illness, some through the workshop side, or the one poor chap, they found he was colourblind. And in the particular trade he was, which I think was electric, it was hopeless, they couldn't use him. So he had to be recoursed and start training again as an engine fitter or what have you see. So you had all sorts of reasons for these people. It was Don Finlay, the hurdler, that recoursed me.
Yeah. Why did you have to do it? What did you find particularly difficult?
It was the problem was, you see, that if you were in the upper grade at the school, they were expecting you to achieve a level which was compatible to your higher national.
Yeah.
Now, if you didn't and they thought you could, they'd send you back. But the snag was that I knew that I would probably never achieve the final exam anyway, so they would have been better to downgrade me in our own group and say, well, he's not going to get it, let him get what he can. But instead of that, they thought I could do higher national, and so I was recoursed, and in the end I didn't get it anyway, although, I still passed out, but I could have done so if they'd just put me in the slower learning group, in other words. Yeah.
How did they actually assess your performance? Were there internal tests?
Constant testing. Mm. There was progress testing all the time, because everything was going in little phases, particularly on the technical side. You did a fortnight's blacksmith and coppersmithing, and then you produce what you had to produce, and you sort of
test piece.
Were either given, and you were given an oral sort of exam, and the instructor sort of said, yes, good lad, and so on, you see. And so you got a grading on that particular phase, and this was going on all the time. And then, of course, after a year, you were probably examined on and recapping on what you should have learned about oxyacetylene welding and all the safety precautions and so on. You got an overall exam that covered what you'd done in the previous 12 months. And subject to getting through those, you went on and on and on.
What sort of scale of groups would you have when you were being instructed in the practical side of things, like silversmithing or tinsmithing?
Or you could have it'd probably be about 30 of you in the shop at a time.
Yeah.
Or you might be split in half and 15 are in the blacksmith shop, 15 are in the silversmith, and change over after a week or so. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned having homework to do. Was this mainly educational homework, or was it...
No, it was mainly doing the notes and diagrams that you had roughly done during the day. You'd taken notes... Or you did a rough sketch, and when you got back, you'd have to sort of do the thing. Because your notebooks were also, I mean, there were some of these lads were artists, and the sectional drawings of engine parts and things like that were absolutely gorgeous to look at. But so long, you had to bring your notebooks up to date. And of course, a lot of the stuff you were given were either photostated handouts. Or you took notes as you went along, and of course that all had to be transcribed into your sort of notebooks and so on.
Fair copy.
Yeah.
Were you taught technical drawing as part of it?
Oh yes, that was one of the subjects of your education. You did engineering drawing. Yeah.
So, it sounds like you had a progressive syllabus teaching you one skill on top of another.
Yeah.
A sort of cascade.
Yeah.
So what were you doing, say, in years two and three?
Well, in year two, you got on to basic engines.
Yes.
And there were certain I think the first engine I did was the Tiger Moth engine, the Gypsy Queen.
Right.
Now, we were being trained mainly for third-line servicing, which was working at places like St Athens.
Yeah.
Now, a third line is repair and overhaul.
Yes.
And it's maintenance unit work. If you get a lot of the people went on to repair and salvage. Mm-hmm. So you get an aircraft crash somewhere. Well, they would go from their base, pick the aircraft up, take it back, take it apart, rebuild all the damaged bits, service all the bits, and hopefully you can put it back together again. At St Athens, they send a lot of engines for repair and overhaul. So the engines go into St Athens, they're taken apart, they go through all the inspection procedures, the good bits are kept and whatnot, all put back together, and out comes a reconditioned engine at the end. Now, this was the type of training they were designing for us to be able to do this. But, of course, at the end of it all, some of you went out onto the squadrons. 50% went to the MUs and to St Athens and places like that. There was, I was one of the lucky ones. I went out onto a flying unit.
Yeah, MU would be a maintenance unit.
Yeah, yeah, Bicester and places like that. You see, so we go through. Now I did. You do a basic engine, which was the Tiger Moth engine to start with, and then the next engine I went on to was the Cheetah, which is a 9-cylinder radial that was in the Anson. And you strip that, and because it's a different technology, because it's radial and so on, you get the basics there. So we've done an inline engine and we've done a radial engine, and then we go to the job we're going to be trained to do.
What is stripping? Is stripping taking it to
taking
pieces?
The engine to pieces. And you've got every sort of a cylinder, and you go into the valve mechanism and what the valves are filled with. You really go into the engine in depth so that you know why things are there. And of course then it's got a carburetor, which is quite difficult, and then you've got hydraulic pumps and pneumatic pumps, and each of these little bits is taken apart, and you do all the drawings. Yeah. And you learn how it works and so on.
And what happens then? Do you have to put it back together
and then
again?
You put it back together again, but yeah. These engines never run. They're you can shake them and they'd fall apart more or less. They're engines that are just stripped and rebuilt to and show you the techniques and get you used to the spanner work.
Like the way in which medical students use a skeleton.
Yeah, yeah. Now then, you get onto the job that you're really there for, and in my case it was repair and overhaul Merlin engines.
Yes.
So you strip the Merlin engine, which the Spitfire and the Lincoln and the Lank and all the rest had, which is quite a long and involved, I think you're 6 weeks on that. Now, then you get a break and you go down to the airfield and you go in the cockpit classrooms, you do inspections on aircraft. I think it's mainly engine testing, and you're running aircraft, you do some flying, sort of for air experience while you're down there. Quite a nice phase, being working amongst aircraft that actually fly and being able to run the engine.
This is all during your time at Halton?
Yeah.
You're sent out on these educational visits to...
No, this is... At Halton,
yes.
There are three main wings. There's the technical wing, there's where the hospital and the three wing is, and then there's the two wings up at this top. But then there's an airfield there.
Right.
And down at the airfield, they've got a lot of aircraft... which can be, some can't be flown, but they're all so-called serviceable aeroplanes. For instance, you'd go and do a minor inspection on a Mosquito engine,
yes.
And then you could tow the aircraft out the hangar and run it and check that your engine that you'd just had in bits didn't leak and worked, you see.
So they're working models then for you to...
Oh, yeah, they're the full-sized aircraft, yeah, but they're for training purposes only.
Specimen aircraft,
yeah,
effectively.
Yeah.
Did you do any bench running as well with engines to
not bench running as much, but what we have is, down there's a bow fighter, which it's only the cockpit and the engines. There's no wings, only the bit with the fuel tank in.
Right.
And then there's a house built on the back, which is a classroom.
Right.
And inside the classroom, the instruments are enlarged. So you're sitting in a classroom doing the running.
And you can see the results
on... They've got the same gauges, but with long pointers on and painted dials. And you can do all the running inside a classroom. In fact, when we've finished, I'll show you the book and you can see what I'm talking about.
So it sounds like you're moving from theory to increasing practice. I mean, you were concentrating on engines, on propulsion.
Yeah.
Did you also get any instruction on airframe and on hydraulics and control systems?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, each of these trades is interrelated,
yes.
And you've got to know the layout of the aeroplane. So, yes, you get some basic sort of airframe and instruments and so on. But, of course, while you're doing this... when you move out from the engine shops down to the airfield, so are your opposite numbers on the airframe side, and they're coming down, so you then meet up with them, and they're doing their bit of the inspection, you're doing yours, and then you liaise together to do the ground runs, because they need flaps and slats and things like that checked off. So then you start to work with other trades.
But does this come in the third year?
No, the second year. The first year's basic training. The second year, you do sort of deeper... You're going into the overhaul of engines and you do the airfield phase. And then the third year, you sort of do similar. You go back to the airfield again for a second stint, but...
Presumably by year three you know more and you're more confident in the knowledge.
That's right, and you're preparing for... I think the educational side of the course finishes. It doesn't take 3 years. It probably takes 2 years and 3 months or 4 months. And the latter part of the course, you're sort of going over... the work you've done and preparing for your final exams, revision and so on. If you've got any weaknesses, they help you through.
How were the final exams conducted when you came to those?
Well, you've got so much coursework that I think you've completed and been marked on.
That's continuous assessment, isn't it?
Yeah, but then there's a special task force comes from... In some cases, it used to be Kirby in Lancashire.
Yes.
In other, they come from St Athens, and they're the trade testing standards people. And you've never met them before. They come down. And they're impartial, but they go to all the schools. There are boy entrance schools at Cosford and so on, and they examine everybody and they set the level. And in some cases, it's oral and written. So if you do badly on a written test, you might find that this chap comes round and says, could you come out and tell me a little bit about this? And they'll do an oral examination. They're very fair, but they certainly don't lower the standards. And it's taken over almost a week, I would think. As I remember it, and you're sitting around waiting to go in, obviously using your time to try and learn what you should have already learnt. And you're taken in, and these examiners just keep coming in next, and they take you out, and you don't know what they're going to ask you. But
did you have to do practical things with the examiners?
Oh yes, there's a final test job, which is this. Well, in our case, I think it was the cube, and it's, you've got to make a steel, it's a hollow, it's quarter inch thick, and it's a square of steel with the centre cut out, and then you get a brass cube, and you've got to file it down and make a perfect brass cube. And it goes into the square in the centre, and you've got to leave go, and this thing has just got to go down very slowly until you put your hand underneath, and you've got 16 different fits that way. And it's quite a precision job. And I mean, it's simple enough in appearance, and you know what it's going to be, but to get the darn thing absolutely perfect, and they sort of measure it, and believe me, well, they down at Halton now, they've got some of the best test jobs that were ever made. And if you see, I mean, you couldn't tell that it hadn't been machine done, you know, and they've done it all by hand, file and chalk and so on.
Did they, did they also have you stripping down engines as part of your final testing to see if you could?
They might have you changing a component, or
yes.
Basically what they sort of say, right, you have this fault, what are you going to do about it? And there's a logical sequence to the investigation of the fault, because it could possibly be caused by three or four different different problems. And so they watch you, the way you sort of work it out as to what is your next step, and you say, well, first I would change that and check it, and if it was still the same, I would change that, and if it was still the same after that, I'd change the engine altogether. And then they'll ask you why you've done it that way, and usually you've got it sort of hacked, you know, because you can't just sort of throw an engine away worth half a million or something without doing some sort of investigative work.
So you came through this year two and then year three, and you got your you were qualified.
Yep.
You passed out. What happened when you were passed out? Did you have a grand parade or anything?
Oh yes, yes. You and that has to be trained for. Sort of while all this examination and you're waiting for the results to do. You must remember that there's a passing out parade every 4 months,
yeah.
And you're part of it, but it's only on the last one that you are actually
passing out.
Yeah. And so you're marching and everything, and you know what the parade's about, but it's, you have to do a march past in line. And it's making sure that you don't get a dog leg and all this sort of thing. And of course, the uniforms and so on have got to be really superb, because the parents are going to be there and the VIPs, and so that comes into the final few weeks. But in the meantime, they've asked you if you if you're not very good and you need to improve a training, then you will be sent to St Athan's, where there's maximum supervision, because you're just a small cog in a big factory. But if you've passed out at a reasonable level, you can then sort of say where you would want to go or what type of work you want.
I was going to ask you if, you know, towards the end of the course you were thinking about postings and whether you had any choice or influence over where you would go?
I don't think I want it to go to St Athens, where 50% of them went. You know, it seemed to be a bit of a factory and not what the Air Force I'd sort of imagined. So I wouldn't have minded wherever they posted me.
As long as it wasn't St Athens.
I mean, I don't think many went straight overseas. Some went straight on to aircrew training. Some went were fortunate enough to be commissioned and go straight to Cranwell for training, either as engineering